You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, Alex.
Hey. Hey, Nick.
Listen, man.
Yeah.
I don't have jokes anymore. And I'll tell you what. I'm just fucking tired.
Like, you dry?
I'm so dry. And I'm just like, we're in the middle of it. We're in the middle of it. Last episode we recorded was going into 2021, and this episode is after the goddamn insurrection at the Capitol.
All this nonsense about by 2020, like, time for 2021 to be better, and then boom.
Boom.
The
boom.
Mutiny on the SS America.
On the SS Minnow America. It's insane. But you know, Biden did come out with his economic plan, and that smells delicious. So excited about that, but like also just processing, man, just processing the,
it's processing. I got something for you to process.
What's up?
They announced today that they are getting rid of the Disneyland annual pass.
Yeah.
You who just moved to the West Coast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Getting ready for all that Disney magic to come back.
Yep.
Getting to sign up for that, you know, go anytime.
Yep.
That you want.
Yep.
And now, nope. Sorry.
Well, I tell you what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm moving back.
Little justice. Fuck yeah.
Which is funny because I am leaving.
Because you actually are.
I'm actually leaving. That's it.
Goodbye.
Bye.
You've been out here. When did you move out here?
I moved out here, like, I don't even remember, like, September, and I'm gone, and I'm already gone.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's why
October, like, so, like, 6 months almost.
Yeah.
I have not seen you once.
No, you haven't seen me once. At all. But now I'm gone. So,
kind of crazy world. Best friend moves 2 hours away.
Yeah.
Haven't seen him in forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, he's here. We're going to hang out all the time. Now, cool. I get COVID is a factor. I understand.
COVID's a major factor.
If you cared, you would have made the effort. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, man. You know what I do care about?
What's that?
My asthma. That's it.
Is the West Coast not good?
No, it's COVID.
I found my edit point way back there.
Oh, you found it.
We just cruise right on.
We're just rambling now. I love it. No, it's my asthma in relation to COVID, dude. I can't risk it. That was the point. However, as I am a professor, I just found this out. I get my shot now.
You get a shot for being a professor?
Because right now they're doing teachers.
Because the world can't operate without drama professors?
I got an email that said, go to any site and show your NYU ID and you will be getting a vaccine.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Interesting. Are you going to do that?
I am. I'm very excited to
do that. Are you worried about the microchips?
Yeah, dude. But you know, I figure I got so many in there anyway.
There's so many
microchips in me anyway.
These assholes going around talking about, oh, I'm not going to take the vaccine because it's got this and that and they're going to track me.
Dude, they want
with their cell phones in their pockets, exactly. And their, you know, every device connected and their Google Home listening to them, and like I'm not going to get a life-saving vaccine.
If they wanted to track you, they would have tracked you over. Like, they're tracking you already. Right
and
now.
Here's the reality. Nobody wants to know where you are anyway. Nobody cares.
Literally nobody cares.
Dude. The only time they'd ever care is if they needed to find you for law enforcement related purposes, which thank God now they are finding everybody for law enforcement related purposes, because if you brought your cell phone to the Capitol for your little insurrection party, they know who you are and that you were there.
You're going down. It was
goddamn Capitol of the United States. Of course, the Wi-Fi is good. There's some serious triangulation going on in there.
That's what's stunning to me is like, truly, what did you think was going to happen? What was this? Was this truly like, oh yeah, we're going to show up to the Capitol and we're like, and clear, you know, now we know that a lot of their plan was to do harm to people. Do you know what I mean? So we're going to show up to the Capitol. We're going to do harm to people. And then the Republicans are just going to take over. Like, that's it? Like, that's what you think happens is you just
get... They'll go in, they'll overturn the election, they'll say, oh, you know what? You're right, based on these actions. Here you go. No.
Like, no. That's not how that works.
You know, they got caught up in the moment. Oh, so, what are you gonna do?
They can get caught up in this dick. That's what they can do.
Oh, man. It's been a real pleasure watching all these videos over the last week come out of people finding out in the airport that they're on the fly list. Oh, it's beautiful. They can't fly.
They can't fly. Gotta fly. Gotta pro.
Consequences of their actions. And it's so wonderful. And why? And all the text messages and things from people just like turning family in left and right. Like, yeah, you just tried to storm the Capitol.
Yes.
You're a disgrace. I'm going to let the FBI know where you are.
Disgrace, a true disgrace. And I think that, you know, what it comes down to for me is this: anytime that your party or your, you know, political belief come down to one person, right? Mm-hmm. Literally a cult of personality surrounding one man, or the idea that you have a bigger stick than they do, that is always going to fail. And let's just say that as a rule, bigger stick, cult of personality mentality is always going to fail. Why? Because somebody else, A, will have a bigger stick than you, and B, people die. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So you cannot sustain on that. What?
And even, yeah, people love to make the Nazi comparison, which, you know, is apt in a lot of ways. But one of the things that doesn't line up is they were not flying Hitler flags. It was not we love Hitler and want to keep Hitler in power forever. This was an ideology. There were actual, you know, points to be made in this ideology about what was important to that party. It was a full political idea. This is people literally with Trump flags, flying Confederate flags through the United States Capitol. Are you fucking kidding me? Like, the messages are so mixed. There's no floor to stand on. There's no foundation to the message. There's no
at all. It's literally just Trump. And at the end, and that's Trump, and
angry people who are on Facebook too much. That's what this is.
No. And again, and I think it's so sad because we talked about this before we recorded. I think what's so sad is these people truly are asking for a lot of things that a lot of people are asking for, right? The actual asks are not that different from the average American. But again, you are believing that this one man can or cares enough to give them to you. And you are believing it after everything that he has done to show you that he will not give them to you.
He won't. Did you hear about the bathroom thing?
No, what's the bathroom thing?
Okay, so it just came out. About $100,000 of taxpayer money has gone to rent an apartment near Jared and Ivanka's house because they would not let the Secret Service use one of their 6.5 bathrooms in their house.
You're lying. You're lying to me.
No, it gets better. It gets better. So they wouldn't let the Secret Service use any of the bathrooms. They have a half bath in there, right? There's not even like, you know, protecting their family, their kids, all this stuff. They made them use a porta potty outside. They got a porta potty on taxpayer dime. The neighbors complained about there being a porta potty outside, so they got rid of it. Temporarily, the Secret Service were using Obama's garage bathroom down the street. They literally went to Obama's house to use the bathroom. And there's just something about that imagery that is so depressing and wonderful.
That's literally America. Let me tell you.
It's America.
That is America. Send it down to Obama's house.
Obama will give you a bathroom.
Obama will, in fact, give you a bathroom.
and then the taxpayer will pay to fix the problem. It's I mean,
I think that we're going to hear so much shit. You can't. And I think we're going to hear so much shit coming out in the next couple of days about that, you know, that is akin to this, just shit that they were doing in while in power that is just so ridiculously inexcusably negligent and irresponsible that, you know, some of it funny like this shit, some of it just straight up criminal.
Fair enough. Yeah. And well, the thing is, they've been doing it kind of out in the open the whole time anyway. So the question is, what consequences are there, if any? You know, I know there's a million investigations. It's hard now. Every day you read someone is launching a new investigation into something. And that, you know, even the second impeachment felt a little neutered because it's like, what's really happening, right? Yeah. Are we just moving through motions to show that we're doing something? Like,
I think there's two things. I think you do have to, I think you, as much as it might be moving through the motions, you do have to set the precedent, right? We need to know that this shit isn't okay. And that even for somebody who, you know, I think Legal Eagle, the YouTube channel, if you follow it, the guy was the host of that channel was talking about something that I really loved, which was like, yeah, when they get into court, the defense lawyer is basically going to go through Trump's rhetoric word by word. And the problem with Trump's rhetoric is it's ambiguous enough that you can't exactly pin, like, he's not saying go be racist and storm the Capitol, right? Like, he didn't say that. So you can get off on technicality, but the host point was like, yes, however, if we don't draw the line here, then we can't draw the line anywhere. Right. And that's why I think the impeachment is important. And quite frankly, also, let's make sure this motherfucker can't ever run again, ever. Like, we need Trump out. Like, Trump.
They need to convict him, right? Yeah. For that to be possible.
He needs to be convicted and he needs to be barred from, I think it does come automatically with conviction. And somebody correct us if we're wrong on that.
Here we are wrapped into politics again. It's impossible not to.
No,
it's really impossible.
It's where we're at in this, you know, and I think this is actually, not to, I'm sure you have a segue plan, but I think I was going to say, I think not even in terms of a punny segue, but I think that it is kind of this segue that I think is so good. Why our topic is what it is this week. Because this week, our first show of 2021, y'all, well, not really, because we actually had a 2021 episode. Yeah. The first show that we're recording in 2021.
First regular show. Yeah.
We chose ghost stories. And I love that we chose ghost stories because I think that that topic, when put into the context of America, I think that America is a country that is in so many ways learning how to deal with its ghosts and learning how to live with its ghosts.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. If you think about American narrative, right? Because America is a young country, 200 years,
yep,
and that's it. The same way that jazz was born in America,
yep,
or American is apple pie, whatever you want to say, in terms of storytelling, Americana, like Southern Gothic is Americana. Like, that is the American story, right? Like, even though we've only been here 200 years, the ghosts of our past are with us always.
Always.
You know, from the Civil War, like for some reason, America is very attached to the ghost story and like to think that we are still, because we are, you know, running from ourselves.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think that's the exactly the point, right? Is that we are running from ourselves and there are things that haunt us. And so it's very unsurprising because I think if there's one thing that unites us all, we as a people, as a culture, as an American culture, are united by that idea of suppression. Like that's, I think, how we cope as a country is and granted, look, I truly do, and I've said this on this podcast before, I really do believe that America is the greatest country in the world. I really do think that. I think that we have the amount of choice and freedom, the beauty of the Constitution as a document, as a ruling document. I think we have so many things that are amazing here, but we have not figured out how to hold space for both that and the things that are wrong and the things that are pained. And until we do, there will always be ghosts. And so it does not surprise me that America as a country of filmmakers, that our cinema has produced so many ghost stories.
Yeah.
Because that's who we are, man.
and horror in general. I mean, usually when somebody wants to probe into, you know, the heart of something, they go to horror, right? It's a very astute way to attack social anxieties. I think Jordan Peele, we talked about him. Was that last week?
Yes. We talked with us. Yeah.
Yeah. Is sort of one of the more recent examples of it, but I mean, it all the way back through the history of film, this has been there, using horror as a way to cope with what we're feeling.
Well, what was one of the first horror movies, but Birth of a Nation? Truly. Like, think about that.
Depends who you ask, I guess.
don't ask the insurrectionists.
I went through, because I'd watched it in film school and completely forgotten, but I went and scrolled through it a couple months ago just to be like, what is this? I was watching something else related to it. The Shangri-La, Lost Horizon, I think.
Sure.
And it got me looking into Birth of a Nation. Really racist.
Really, you know, Alex, in fact,
really indicative of a time in a startling way.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say that The Birth of a Nation, racist film.
A slightly racist film.
Slightly racist.
In an almost comical way now.
Well, I mean, but not even, because that film, and, you know, again, somebody correct me on my history, but I'm pretty sure that film was, you know, definitely one of the films that inspired the reinvigoration of the Ku Klux Klan.
Absolutely.
You can draw
and it, but it also gave birth to Hollywood.
Yes,
like it's so American. It's so American that like something like that, and the detractor, you know, the detractors are still like, there's like a middle ground that people had to meet on. It's like a yes, but maybe we should all try to get along anyway. Like, look at the good stuff that came out of it too.
It's so insane.
Which is insane.
And I'm looking at this. I just looked it up on Wikipedia just now. And I'm looking at this poster. Y'all, if you had a chance, look at the poster for Birth of a Nation, because it's literally a Klan member looking like a Knight of the Round Table. Like, it is literally a Klan member on horseback, like riding to save the day. And that's what so much of this movie is, you know, if, for those of you who have never seen Birth of a Nation, you know, and I'm reading this now, 1915 American silent drama film. That is a landmark of film history because it was the first 12 reel film ever made. And it depicts the saving of a white woman by a dumb, sexually aggressive black man who was really played by a white actor in blackface, and the Ku Klux Klan comes and saves her and saves the day. And it is truly a distillment of everything that we're facing right now. It is like, that you can find everything in this movie. Fascinating.
Yeah, fascinating. But I wouldn't consider it a horror movie, except from this perspective, maybe.
Fair.
But there were, I'm trying to think from that era, you get a lot of, you know, there's like Nosferatu, Frankenstein, and all the, you know, the kind of stories that people knew, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, kind of more, you know, stylish, experimental horror.
Well, and horror, I think at that point, you're dealing with what? You're dealing with horror, because all these, you know, all these stories, you know, Dracula and Frankenstein all come from an era where we are starting to question God, and we are starting to question, you know, our kind of morals as a culture. So all these characters that you're describing are characters who very much go against that that Victorian moral structure. You know, and people who are trying,
well, they're deformities of it. They're monstrosities.
Exactly.
To the normal order. So if an outright monster is that, right, is a mutation of society.
Yeah.
Is something that stands outside of it. What is a ghost?
I mean, I love a ghost because I think a ghost is trauma. I think a ghost is, and that's going back to Sixth Sense rules, right? That's the, you know, they're here because they have some, there's some unfinished business. It's those things that we can't let go of, right? Those things. I mean, I think, you know, and I hope I'm not taking your movie away by talking about Sixth Sense right now. Am I? Did you choose that?
I did not. I mean, but,
good.
I wish that I did.
It's such a good fucking movie. I mean, it's so beautiful. God. It is so good. And I was recently reading that script, and
so the script is pitch perfect.
It is literally a perfect piece of
literature. It really is like M. Night Shyamalan started at the top and rolled downhill.
And rolled the fuck downhill to After Earth. But it's such an amazing, and even in that first setup, and I'm sorry if anybody hasn't seen this, so, you know, spoiler alert, but the first scene is you know, our hero getting shot by one of his former patients. That sets up the very idea of unresolved business, right? Mm-hmm. These people who come back to haunt you because they are not resolved. And that's what I think, that's what always what a good ghost story is, of people who their stories just weren't finished. And that is what trauma is.
Yeah. And it's interesting the way it can be portrayed, right? Because whether it's a malicious ghost, whether it's somebody, you know, like The Ring or something, where this ghost is here to kill you and there's a very kind of intentional evil about it.
Yeah.
Or it's a more casual ghost. It's just like the spirit of somebody who's there.
Yeah.
I think the best ghost stories kind of do both.
Yes.
But it is always about that kind of unfinished business, right? It's always about somebody's life energy. Somebody is doing something, stands for something, is carrying some kind of emotional capacity.
Yeah.
And then when they die, there's an incompleteness to it that it's almost like a universal thing.
Yes.
It's like a you can't finish your job in this universe. Where you started. Until something happens, until some kind of thing is complete.
Yes.
It's a beautiful concept.
It really, and I think that's why ghost stories have the, you know, once you get away from the, you know, not the Paranormal Activity is not a beautiful movie, because we've actually discussed Paranormal Activity in this podcast.
Not a beautiful movie.
You would say it's a well-made movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I wouldn't call it like any kind of poetic.
No, it's not.
I don't think that they're even what, like the Blair Witch. Okay. Poetic.
Poetic.
Same style of thing, same whatever, but there's an actual ethos, but there's a character to the ghost. There's whatever you're looking at. Paranormal Activity is, I don't think, and maybe it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I don't think that there's really a story behind why the ghosts are there doing what they're doing. Is there? I agree.
No, I don't remember it being the such. But my point in bringing it up was to say that, you know, like with, you know, it doesn't have to be this, but I think that a ghost story has probably the most room to have an underlying, you know, deep intellectual, emotional core, because it's at the very base. I think it's just about something so human. Like, there is a world, and I did not choose this, A, because I already chose it, but B, because it's not a ghost story, Us, right? Us, what I chose last week. There is a world in which I do consider Us a kind of ghost story. It's not by any means, those are not ghosts, but the idea of a home invasion movie is a kind of ghost story, right? Like, even Funny Games has elements of that, they share elements with the ghost story, because it is about these people interrupting your life and bringing your attention to something that you missed, right? In Funny Games, it's a kind of about the safety that this family feels, right? They took their safety for granted, and now we're going to have fun commenting on the fact that, like, we enjoy watching people safety broken for fun. And then in Us, it's very much, you know, it's a whole other thing. But I think that that is an element of the ghost story, of your world being expanded by force, by something that you tried to move forward with.
It's a confrontation of the other, like, and it's an other that is present with you, right? It's about something being in your space that you're unaware of, suddenly rearing its head. So it can get translated metaphorically into so many different things.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love it.
I know I've talked about it before. I think maybe on our first town hall, I brought it up. One of the best ghost stories on film of the last decade, maybe longer, is Haunting of Hill House.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Second season, not as good. Haunting of Bly Manor, still great.
We tried
not
as Bly good. Manor. Yeah. We had to stop with Bly Manor because it wasn't as
not good. As cohesive. Yeah. But I mean, I've been through Haunting of Hill House twice, and it's just like,
it holds up.
In terms of how they shoot it, the mood that they present, right? It somehow retains its horror all the way through. you're never comfortable watching it. Usually like a horror, after a while you get used to the scares, you get you kind of comfortable in your space to engage with it. All the way to the end, they keep it scary, but they also keep it very, very human and organic.
That.
And they dig into the character. It's like the 10 episodes or 7 episodes, however long it is just long enough to get to know these characters and like each one of the siblings and the parents and figure out, you know, who they are and why this is all happening. And it affects them all differently. And like it plot wise, it all kind of comes full circle. What you see in the first episode and the last, like it's a really beautiful way to use a classic story. Cause it's based on The Haunting of Hill House by what's her name?
Oh yeah.
An old book.
Yeah, we got to look it up.
Not Virginia Woolf.
No, it's. I wish it was Virginia Woolf. Haunting of Hill House.
Virginia.
Let's see. Let's see who's going to find it first. We're going to find it first.
Oh, I'm not even looking. I'm just letting you do it.
Oh, let's see. Shirley Jackson.
Shirley Jackson. I don't know where Virginia was coming from. Shirley Jackson.
Yeah.
Because like it's also a very, very ghost movies are very, very overdone.
Yes.
It's an easy thing, right? It's like, oh, I'm in my safe house with my family. It's always like moving into a new house.
Yep.
That's big and creepy looking. And then things start to happen and it goes downhill from there. It's been done over and over and over and over. So when you can find something new to bring to it, when you can find a new human element to explore, it's exciting.
I agree. And I'm glad that you chose Haunting of Hill House because that is a direct tie-in to my choice.
Let's do it.
Direct tie-in. All right, man. So ghost stories. I'm going to preface this. I don't think this is the best ghost story. I don't even think it's my favorite ghost story, but it is a ghost story that is in my head right now that I have watched several times over the course of this quarantine. That I am truly, I really think is a powerful ghost story.
You didn't pick Haunted Mansion, did you?
I did not pick Haunted Mansion. No. I mean, Eddie Murphy. God love him, but no.
That movie was scary bad.
Scary bad. And little insider information. The chairs around the dining table in Haunted Mansion are featured now in what Disneyland ride, sir?
The chairs around the
dining table in Haunted
Mansion. I assume the answer is not Haunted Mansion.
It is not Haunted Mansion.
Pirates? They stick them in Pirates?
Pirates. It is
chairs from the movie into Pirates?
It is now the chair that Jack Sparrow sits in at the end of the ride.
No shit.
In Pirates, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Nice trivia.
Thank you.
Glad you won't see it again for a long time.
I know. Until I get my vaccine there. It's going to be great. insider joke. Anyway, so this movie starts in the 70s, but we don't know that when the movie opens. It opens from above on a canopy of green trees and goes slowly, slowly, slowly pushing in. A young girl at a camper with her parents playing around, and she wanders off. The mother tells her not to go too far, as mothers do. She wanders off to a body of water, sees a woman sitting on a rock with a big old magician's hat.
Oh my God.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Interesting. Buddy. Interesting choice.
Oh, I am obsessed.
I've never. Okay. Well, so the film is Dr. Sleep.
Dr. Sleep.
Well, hi there. You want to let me go? No, no, sweetie. No, I don't.
Dr. Sleep.
So I never got through it.
Really?
I think I've seen half of it. I don't really know. So I'm a huge, huge
Mike Flanagan fan. Okay, cool.
Well, and Mike Flanagan fan. Yeah. So I watched Havoc because I had watched Haunting of Hill House, yeah. And I thought, oh my God, I want, and I went back and I watched Oculus.
Yeah.
And his debut feature, which was, I forget what the name even is, but was it really,
Ouija,
really
Ouija good. Or whatever?
No, it wasn't Ouija. He got Ouija off of this other one. It was like an indie feature they shot in LA.
Gotcha.
In some weird house, about like a dude who lives in, like a guy disappears, basically like into hell, like through this tunnel. There's like a tunnel.
Oh, wow.
Near this house, and this person disappears and nobody knows, this woman's husband, And like at her recovering from it, she starts getting exposed to the, it's cool. It's very low budget, but it's good. But Dr. Sleep, like I'm a huge Shining fan. I loved the book so much and I haven't read Dr. Sleep, but like I was excited for this. I don't know. Tell me about, I'm talking too much. Tell me why Dr. Sleep.
So here's the thing. I've read in reviews that people felt that it was an uneven film and I get where those people are coming from. I did not feel it. I didn't feel that it was uneven. I felt that it was actually really well paced. It is a long movie and it is a slow burn. Mm-hmm. But it almost needs to be. And there's I would compare it to a Hateful Eight. I think there's some fat that could easily be cut off, but I think that I would never want it to lose its pace of the slow build, because that is very in line with its predecessor, The Shining, right? Mm-hmm. Arguably one of the greatest, if not the greatest horror film of all time. I think with these characters, they are drawn so subtly that you want to give them time to become who they are. I'm a sucker for a movie that takes its time getting the character to the place where they are, where mm-hmm. The chunk of this movie, the heart of this movie, is when they return to the Overlook Hotel. That is when the movie like really is, I think it's that final showdown. It's Danny, you know, Danny Torrance reckoning with the ghosts of his past. But we take a long, long time to get there. And I love the journey to get there. Because it is, I think that the thing that they did so well that I think that I know Stephen King was so happy about, and you know, one of the reasons why he was not too hot on The Shining adaptation was because of how much it cut out mm-hmm. the struggle of alcoholism. And yeah. that is largely what this movie is squarely about, is alcoholism.
On the house. This was your brand. Jack Daniels. I used to see the bottles in our home. Our real home before all this. I smelled one once. It smelled like something on fire, which I suppose it was.
Is it still the focus of it?
It is so the focus of Dr. Sleep. Like, it literally, the movie, I'd say it holds off several scares to give you some great character beats with the... So, okay, for everybody who doesn't know what this movie's about, let me slow down. So this movie takes place... Well, really, it actually starts like maybe a month after the events of The Shining. The Shining, of course, being the story of Danny Torrance and Jack Torrance and Wendy Torrance, the Torrance family who are Jack, the patriarch, is asked to move into the Overlook Hotel and be its caretaker over a winter. And the Overlook Hotel ends up having a ghostly power inside that feeds on Jack's alcoholism and his resentment of his family and turns him against his family. And, you know, in a very famous Jack Nicholson scene, has him chasing his family throughout this hotel with an axe. And it's horrifying. It's really a very powerful movie. This film picks up right after that and is Danny, the son. In The Shining, you found out that he has a power called The Shining, or that he calls The Shining, that allows him to interact with the dead and allows him kind of psychic powers and all these kind of... It's actually a very undefined power.
Very undefined, yeah.
But the beginning of Dr. Sleep is him learning how to use that power. And it takes him a long time. Like, he starts off on this journey when he's a kid, but then by the time he's like early 30s, he's just like his dad. He's alcoholic, fighting with mm-hmm. bar people, you know, waking up in rooms that he doesn't know who they belong to, and then he goes on another journey of like trying to kick it again, and that's the journey that proves to be successful. He finally does kick it, at least for a while, and at that moment he meets a young woman, a young girl named Abra, who is in his new town that he's in, who also has The Shining, but has it stronger than he ever had it. And Abra is being pursued by this woman named Rose the Hat, played by Rebecca Ferguson in this movie. And she's basically a witch who pretty much, you know, kind of has The Shining, but more so is kind of a Shining cannibal, like feeds on people who have The Shining. So, like, you know, puts them in enough pain to where their Shining turns into smoke and, like, sucks the smoke out of them. And the movie becomes about grown up Danny Torrance and Abra defeating Rose the Hat. But what is so wonderful, like I said, is just the beats of character study and the beats, like the long journey that it takes Danny. It takes him about 40 years to really kick this habit. And even when he's kicked it, it's still not like he's just keeping it at bay, you know? Mm-hmm. And you really, Ewan McGregor's performance is so good and it's so quiet. And
I thought it was an interesting element of this movie is because if you told me, like, hey, like, they're gonna do a sequel to The Shining,
yeah,
incorporating footage from The Shining and characters from the Kubrick version, knowing how Stephen King felt about it, also, it sounds like a really bad idea. But they kind of pull it, like, they recast a bunch of roles, like, from the original act. I know Scatman Crothers' character, they cast with somebody else. I think Wendy,
all of them,
they found somebody to play Wendy, all of them, which, like, why do you think that works when it really, really shouldn't?
So I think that's actually something I wanted to bring up. I think that one of the cool things in the theme of talking about ghosts, right? Shelley Duvall and Jack Nicholson's performance in that movie, in The Shining, are iconic. You cannot get around the fact that especially if this movie is taking place in the Kubrick world, which it is, you cannot get around who those people were and the what they brought to the screen. I think, to Mike Flanagan's credit, I think that what he decided to do was, rather than do some de-aging bullshit, use the essence of the kind of film, of the genre of the film, to his advantage, and say, I just want people who fill out the essence of these characters. I don't want carbon copies. I'm not trying to make carbon copies, because this is not, you know, The Shining was, I think the way I interpret it is, The Shining was very much seen through Jack's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
This is Danny's. So how did Danny see these people? And it works to that extent. Like Wendy is a much more grounded character in this movie than she is in The Shining, right? The Shining, she's kind of, you know, in a place that she's on the edge of madness from the beginning. Here she is a much more, like, you get to see her separate from Jack after they've moved on from Jack, and she's just a good mother and she cares for her son and they have a good relationship, and it's a really cool thing. So I think that's part of it. And there are other characters that come up that I don't want to ruin anything for anybody who's seen it, who he recasts, and it works. Like, it all works because it's its own film and it's seen through a very different character's eyes. Yeah. But what I love most about it, I think Mike Flanagan knows how to film a ghost story better than anyone else right now. I really think that he just deals, maybe in America. I think I'm pretty sure there's some Japanese filmmakers working right now who would kick his ass. But in terms of American filmmakers, just in terms of, like, the negative space and allowing for sound and for just a hint of images to do the work for you. There are so many things that are just really powerful about this film, and a sense of tension playing with those, with that iconography of, you know, who usually dies in these films, and stretching that out as long as you can, and just giving you well-rounded characters. Like, I think that goes back to having such a great source material. Obviously, this book, Dr. Sleep.
I mean, that's so important. A ghost story and horror in general, I think, is where a lot of people lose it, is not having the grounding of not knowing who your character is.
Yeah.
And why you should care in the first place, right? Like, something coming to kill you is only threatening if you care about what is going to die.
Exactly. Exactly. And why it's coming to kill you. You know, I think,
right.
I think it's one thing just to have scares, but like, I think that's one of the most, you know, Rebecca Ferguson in this movie is so good. And mm-hmm. one of the reasons she's so good is because she has so much material to work with. And you very quickly understand that for her character, this cannibalism is how she knows to survive. It's not about, you know, she does absolutely have a sociopathic bent to her, but she is more just somebody who is afraid to die, who truly does not want to die.
Such a gifted boy, hiding his light under a bushel for so long. You could live a long, long time, live well too. Indulge yourself. No consequences, no hangovers. Eat well, live long.
You must be lonely, being the last one. I mean, the last one in the world.
Sweetie, I'm not the last, far from it. I'm just the prettiest.
He really is afraid of facing that, you know, just in, again, in line with the film, facing that inevitability of reckoning, you know, and going back and facing up to the eventuality of anything. And so she's like, it is worth it to her to kill thousands, millions of people just in order to live a little longer. And that very much ties in with Danny's struggle, right? Of alcoholism, right? The idea that it is worth it to you to destroy your life and other people's lives with alcohol.
Yeah.
In order to not have to face up to the pain that you can't reconcile. And right. So it's just a beautifully constructed film in that way. Like I said, a little long, not perfect. And the final showdowns at the Overlook, you know, can sometimes feel, for a movie that has really been so subtle with its Easter eggs, I think by the time you get back to the Overlook, they it is a little like, oh my, okay, yeah, we're back in The Shining, like, but that is not a fault that like takes me out of it. I really do love how it ends. It's not overdone. It's just,
yeah, I mean, I think if I have one and again, I haven't watched it, I didn't know it went back to the Overlook, and I'm super interested now.
Oh, you got
to,
yeah,
get to the end. My one problem with it compared to the first one is it seems more fantasy.
Oh yeah, I agree.
Right, it does this thing, and Stephen King's son, Joe Hill, wrote a book called Nosferatu.
Yeah,
I don't know if you read it. They turned it into a show with Zach Quinto, I think. It's the same kind of thing. There's a bevy of characters that have supernatural powers that are never explained. Right, they're just kind of evil and introduced. And they exist from the beginning almost like a deus ex machina, you know, like there's nothing to them except that they are weird and they have, you know, they give them a weird character traits and they have these superpowers. And so you can kind of use them however you want. It's kept me from really, just because The Shining itself is so straightforward as a ghost story.
Yeah.
And it thematically, it's so on point and never, you know, they don't introduce a random evil guy out of, you know, who shows up in a weird jacket and a weird car and like, I'm weird and I'm here for you now. It's very much it's about the characters and it stays with the characters and it's them dealing with all the outward pressures. And Dr. Sleep to me just seemed a little more, I don't know, it broadened the world maybe a little too much for me.
And I've heard that. I've absolutely heard that is a complete, like that actually Tori said it to me. Our friend Tori said, he's like, you know, I loved it except for this goddamn, you know, knockoff Gambit from the X-Men character who's like just right. You know, running around. And I was like, yeah, like I get it. I get that. I think that he took a big swing, right? Because if you think about it structurally, in The Shining, it's the house, right? The house is that mm-hmm. is that energy that is looking to cannibalize on Danny's talent, his shining. In Dr. Sleep, it's a person. And so it definitely does have a very different feel than The Shining. It is not trap people in a house and chase them with their demons. It is, you know, your demons have kind of splayed all over the world and they are slowly but surely gathering speed and strength to come find you and make you pay. And that is a very different type of movie.
Interesting.
You know, but I bought it because for the mere fact that we know so little, to the film's credit in The Shining and the book, we know so little about the actual lore of The Shining that to me it felt like, okay, there is room to build off of this into something a little more specific, because what does it say? If the ghosts of the Overlook are this powerful, what does that say about the world in which they're in?
Right.
But again, yeah. I understand that criticism, because it is a very people went into this movie, like the marketing team had a choice here. They could either connect it to The Shining or not. And they chose to, because why would you ever want to lose that brand recognition?
Right.
However, looking at the title of, I just want to make sure I'm saying this right when I look it up. But looking at the novel, 2013 novel that he wrote, that cover does not in any way let you know that it's a sequel to The Shining. Like,
no.
There's no reference to it at all. It looks like an entirely different book. And I think that actually might have been the better way to push it. Because I think the expectation that it's going to somehow, fulfill the beats of The Shining
right.
is an expect, like, and also because The Shining, there is no way you make a movie as good as The Shining. I'm sorry. It's just not going to happen. Do you mean like it's just in terms of like that movie is,
I think that's the reticence, is like, not only does The Shining not need a sequel, was it not built for a sequel?
Yes.
But it seems like they're using it as marketing. Like there's nothing that says Dr. Sleep needs to exist. So it's either they're trying to do something really new, and let's see what there is no way that you walk into Dr. Sleep gung ho about it. Really,
yeah.
It's more curiosity than anything. Like, okay, like The Shining was great. Wonder what this is going to be.
Yeah.
And I think that kept me from engaging with it on the level that I should have. So I'm going to go back and do it.
If you can separate it from The Shining, I think that you will have a movie that really does a lot of wonderful things. And that I had to really get that idea out of my head. Yeah. I was like, this is not The Shining. It is a very different film, but on its own, it really is.
It's interesting. It's my mom is a therapist.
Yeah.
And she got her start. Her specialty was working in ACOA, the adult children of alcoholics.
Yeah.
Which is, you think about alcoholism as a problem, and you think about the alcoholic as the problem and the person who needs the help and all that stuff. You don't think about the people who live under the effect of an alcoholic and what that does, and the children who have to grow up with alcoholics.
Yes.
Which is a whole other spectrum of trauma and of stuff to work through and as you get older and become an adult. So it sounds like this gets into that.
It does. I would say very well. Very well.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
Check it out.
Cool.
Check it out.
Dr. Sleep. I love it. My dinner just showed up.
Ooh.
I don't know. What do we got, babe? Burritos?
Yeah.
I got some burritos. Nick says hi. She says hi back.
I hear that. It's
I guess. Well, I guess we'll move on to mine.
Talk to me.
Then.
Let me hear it.
So, okay. So, ghost stories. So recently I shared with you the book I'm writing, right?
Yes, you did. Brilliant. And by the way, Alex, for those of you listening, Alex Smolo, great writer.
Great writer. Who knew?
Who knew?
Who knew? We'll see. It's been coming along. But it's given me a way, it was interesting. I showed you some pages and we had a conversation about it, and you kind of brought up that my natural inclination in storytelling is to cover loss.
Yeah.
All the stories I do have something to do with a great, great loss. So like the book I'm writing about someone whose wife dies and going, searching for her soul basically. So that's kind of where my emotional creative mind goes when it comes to ghost stories. It's like that's what really turns me on, is like what a ghost represents is something that you had that went away, and it's coping with not being able to get at something that you had and understanding it and coming to a conclusion with it, right? Coming to a reality where it doesn't matter, where it's always going to be with you. but more, you know, not like my favorite ghost stories are not the ones where there's shit popping out at you and trying to kill you. Mm-hmm. So that being said, my selection, I saw this movie when it came out a couple years ago, not knowing much about it. And I was just wrapped up in it. Yeah. I've seen it twice, once then and once now watching it for this. Since I watched it the first time, I just remembered it. Yep. Like emotionally what it carried with me and visually, and just something about it really, really resonated with who I am.
Yeah.
And it's pretty obvious. Okay. Given the title. But so it starts out, there are two people on a couch, husband and wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, you don't know. It opens up, we're in square aspect ratio, and the woman, they're laughing with each other, and she just says,
"Why are you laughing?" I'm so scared. I don't know.
Don't be scared. Quote pops up. Whatever hour you were there was a door shutting. Virginia Woolf, A Haunted House. That's probably why it was in my head. Virginia Woolf. It's a quote from A Haunted House. And then it goes back to them on the couch. And she starts talking about how when she was a little girl, she would write notes to herself and leave them all over the place so that she could find them again. And when she found them, it would be like finding a piece of herself and reconnecting with her past self, reconnecting with something she thought wasn't around anymore. It goes on for a while. These are very long shots that just sit on these actors being with each other, curled up in bed, slow.
Can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. Are these pretty much the only two actors in the film?
Pretty much.
Is it a ghost story?
Yeah.
Yep.
A ghost story.
Yeah.
What is it you like about this house so much? Seriously.
History?
What does that mean?
Hi, we've got history.
Not as much as you think.
The film is a ghost story.
So yeah, talk to me about it, because I actually have not seen it.
Casey Affleck. So you haven't seen it?
I have not seen it yet.
Okay, so how do you explain this movie? Okay, so a ghost story, for context, is directed by David Lowry, who his first debut feature, not his first feature, but his breakout feature was a film called Ain't Them Body Saints. With the same two actors who are in this movie, Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. Then he, off the success of that, he went and he made Pete's Dragon for yes. Disney, right? So what happens with directors when they make a big hit, an indie hit, they get approached to do bigger things. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So he flew to New Zealand or Australia or something to go make Pete's Dragon, big money, big schedule, big everything, Disney, you know, whatever. So he was wrapping up post-production on this thing, completely exhausted. And this is a guy, he's from Texas. He's like kind of the artsy type, you know, cinephile, whatever, really just wants an experience to kind of ground him again. Yeah. After this whole big thing. Not that it went bad. The movie turned out well, you know, it wasn't like a bad experience, but he wanted to do something. So he had an idea for this thing. I was reading about it based on something that he was having a fight with his wife about moving back to Texas. And he realized that he started wondering why he's so connected to physical spaces, right? He wanted to move back there because he missed it. And he started wondering about it, and it was kind of mixed with an anxiety about the world ending and climate change and something. I don't know.
Wow.
So he came up with this idea for a ghost story. Super simple premise where it's a couple living in a house and the guy dies. He just gets into a car accident right out front and dies and becomes kind of trapped in this house and spends the whole movie under basically a bed sheet with eyes cut out, representing him just being there. It's never... He doesn't move very quickly. He just stands there. There's no aggressiveness to it. It's not really a physical presence. It's like an emotional presence. He's just there in this house.
So would you even say that this is like a horror movie as much as it's a supernatural?
This is not a horror movie.
Wow.
This is not, it's an existential horror movie in the sense that it gets you thinking about everything, about about where you are and who you're with and where you're going, basically over the course of the film. So he dies, you spend more time, she's in the house, you know, there's an incredible scene. As an actor, I think you're going to really appreciate what Rooney Mara does in this movie.
Oh, I always do.
There's one thing, and she didn't have to do it, I think. In reading about it, you know, she didn't have to do this, but the real estate agent brings over like a, I'm sorry, your husband died pie.
Jesus Christ.
You know, like, oh, I left this for you. And again, this movie is all very, very long takes. It just sits there. It just lets you sit there and watch. And so she picks up this pie. You know, she comes in the door, puts her bags down, whatever, sees the pie, picks up a fork, kind of starts to go at it more, sits down on the floor and eats the entire pie in one sitting, and then goes and throws up. Like, she actually did this. Just like letting it go deeper and deeper and deeper, and just desperately struggling, trying to get this food to give her what she was looking for, like any kind of relief to the trauma she was facing, to the, you know, the grief she was struggling with. And he's standing there in the bedsheet in the background watching as this happens.
Yep.
You know, not trying to interact, just observing. And what starts to happen is time starts to become a little bit fractured, you know, not in terms of jumping back and forth, but in terms of all of a sudden the camera will cut around the corner and it'll be a week later, and then it'll cut and it'll be 2 years later.
Wow.
And you watch, she brings somebody home after a while, and he kind of, the spirit that he is kind of lashes out, you know, something falls off a shelf, but that's it. That's all that happens. And then she packs up, she moves on, a new family comes in, he deals with them. Before she moves out of the house, she writes on a little piece of paper, sticks it in the wall, and paints over it. And he spends the whole movie as this ghost. The only thing he does, even as time passes, is kneel down and scrape at it, trying to get to it. Just to try to get to her, and that can, and what this means, that he's been separated from her and she's gone, and he stays in the house, and then the house gets demolished near the end, and the city grows up around him, and the music, I mean, the music's amazing. And it all loops back to the beginning again. The whole universe kind of resets and loops back. It's just, it's a very, very, it's heady. It's artful, it's stylish. It's very low budget, very, like, you can tell that it's a work of, a work of passion.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things, man, that just leaves you thinking, you know, it just leaves you in this emotional, like, swamp where you don't know who you are anymore after you've watched it. And yeah, so that to me makes it a successful ghost story. In that's what you're supposed to be thinking about, right?
No, it's I love that. I think that's so fucking cool. And I love anybody who's trying to push the form. Like, I even looked at his, I was reading a review. I just went and like kind of scanned a review of his Pete's Dragon, right? And mm-hmm. and so, you know, and they're saying that he brought something new to, you know, he didn't just do the Disney movie, that he actually, you know,
right,
tried to push the, and I think that that's what it takes. And especially in a ghost story where, you know, yeah, you could go for the jump scares, you can go for this, but you're talking about somebody who's like, no, let me do an examination of what it means to lose and what it means to be lost.
Completely. And it was interesting as I'm watching it, trying to notice the feeling that it gives you, right? Because there's certain things that a ghost movie, a horror movie even does, right? There's like a, you get that anxiety of knowing what's, something's going to happen, you know, that there, it's the whole idea that right in front of you, it is not what it seems.
Yep.
And he does that, you know, that there is that horror. It's just approached from a completely, I want to say, like, humanistic, literary kind of perspective, where it's the dread of eternity. It's like, you're watching this thing just stand in this house as an echo, and understanding that he can't go anywhere, right? That this casual, everybody's got it. It's just this relationship where you love this person, but you have problems and you're making plans and life's going on. And then to suddenly just be ripped out of it, but left in it is just, it's like a hollow feeling that you get. It's really, it's not a fun movie to watch.
No, I would imagine not. I would imagine this is actually a pretty decent.
It's, yeah, hard. It is.
So, you can write a book, but the pages will burn. You can sing a song and pass it down. You can write a play and hope that folks will remember it. Keep performing it. You can build your dream house. But ultimately, none of that matters any more than digging your fingers into the ground to bury a fence post or fucking, which I guess is just about the same thing.
It's hard. It's hard. If you're willing to get on its level, you could also, you know, it could also put you to sleep or make you go, whatever.
Yeah.
Depends on who you are and what you like. But I know for me, you know, trying to engage scene by scene and break it down and feel what they're trying to get at, just there's such a connection to it that I have.
I love it.
So A Ghost Story, David Lowery, please watch it. Like I said, the performances are amazing. Music is amazing.
I'm also looking and seeing that he is directing the new Peter Pan and Wendy.
He is. So back to Disney.
Back to Disney. And that's always a good sign when they bring you back.
It is. I'm nervous about Peter Pan, man. They've never made a good Peter Pan movie. Think about how many people have tried. How many times have they done Pan?
Why would you say that to me? Why would you say
okay,
that to me?
Okay, since Hook.
Thank you.
They've tried. Peter Pan is one of those things, right? It's in the public domain, so yes. Whoever can do whatever with it. And they think, oh, well, everyone knows Peter Pan, so we'll do a new take on it, right? And they keep trying. There was Pan, and then there was Peter Pan. I don't know. I can't even keep track of them. There's the one Hugh Jackman was Captain Hook. And then the guy who did Beast of the Southern Wild just came out with Wendy, trying to put his spin on it, his kind of artsy, like it's about trying to hang on to childhood, you know, give power to youth kind of whatever, where the pirates are just people. And I worry every time a Peter Pan movie is going to come out, because I just think that there's a disconnect.
Well, I think that if you do this right, if you do it right, what makes a Peter Pan movie great? I think that people get very, very bogged down in the fantasy of it, very bogged down in the style of it, right? What is your Hook going to look like? What is your Peter Pan going to look like? All these things. And I think that, to me, what makes the Peter Pan story so wonderful is that idea of, and it's funny, we just talk about loss, but that idea of childhood found again, right? Mm-hmm. You have in Wendy, you have a young woman who, you know, her father and mother are trying to force her to grow up. She's not ready to grow up. And Peter Pan is literally the personification of don't ever grow up. Don't ever grow up. You know what I mean? And rebel and live this adventure. And I think that that is why Hook was so, to me, is so wonderful. And I know other people disagree with me, but that
absolutely
Hook is that film. Because,
I mean, it inverts the Peter Pan story a little bit, right? It makes what Peter Pan represents something, you know, hopeful, Spielbergian.
But I think that's kind of what, I think any good Peter Pan story is a story that to be honest with you, I think the success of the Peter Pan story depends on how you draw Wendy. Because also how you, like, I think that there is a, like, so many of these Peter Pan movies, like, that I've seen have just tried to, like, do, you know, make this into, like, some prestige film and stuff. Peter Pan is, like, he's a little anarchist. Like, he's crazy. Do you mean he's...
Oh, right. Like, what does it represent? Like, what is the message of Peter Pan?
It's the why. It's like, it's the imagination. It's the everything is possible. It's rules don't apply, right?
Right. Well, that's why Hook worked, because the message of Hook is like, you're going to grow up and that's okay as long as you keep your little spark.
Exactly.
And that's like, that's the message of Hook. But the message of Peter Pan is like, get away from the adults.
Well, but no, wait, but what the message of Peter, because at the end of the day, Wendy returns back to London, right?
Right.
To me, I think the thing that they miss in Peter Pan is that Peter Pan
doesn't go with her.
No, it's Peter Pan is not a perfect character. Peter Pan, like especially in today's context, Peter Pan is actually like it's almost like he and Hook are actually on kind of the same. If I'm telling the Peter Pan movie, I'm telling it through Wendy's eyes, because Peter Pan and Hook are on the same wavelength of like Hook is absolutely on the extreme side of this, but Peter Pan's whole thing is like no, you shouldn't have to grow up sooner than you want to, which is Hook's thing. But Peter Pan at the same time is like, you can't be a kid forever. That's the tragedy of Peter Pan. That's the heart of it, is like, yeah. Wendy chooses to go grow up. And so it has to be this choice, right? You could live as a kid forever, or you need to understand that, like, yeah, you're going to grow up, like you will. And facing what that actually means. And that goes back to, you know, the Finding Neverland, which I think is such a beautiful movie. That idea of like trying to protect childhood, because in adulthood, what does adulthood bring is disease and death and an understanding of the world. And Wendy having to make that choice of, yeah, you know what? I'm not ever going to become a Captain Hook, but I can't be a Peter Pan forever either. I have to at some point grow up. So I don't know what they're going to do, but I think that's,
I trust it in this guy's hands.
So do I.
Though.
Yeah. Except from what you're telling me, it sounds like
one of our most talented directors right now that we've got.
Very excited for it. Very excited.
Yeah. Well, that, all right then.
Ghost Story.
Dr. Sleep, Ghost Story.
Love it.
Let us know
what you think it should.
How's our Twitter been doing?
I mean, I have not been on the Twitter actually, so I'm pretty sure our Twitter is dormant. So let me.
You've been off Twitter.
I've been off social media since the insurrection. Yeah, I have not checked once. So
wow,
you know, guys, yeah, let me, you know, tweet at me, and as soon as I get back on that Twitter, I will.
Nick's Twitter, a ghost story.
Nick's Twitter, a ghost story. But guys, stay safe. You know. If we don't talk to you before the inauguration, happy inauguration day. You know, don't overrun the Capitol. Don't do it.
Just don't do it.
Just don't do it.
Get some champagne.
Yeah. Sit back and just
sit back and enjoy.
Enjoy. All right, y'all. Peace.
Bye.
Little justice.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.